You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
Biopsychology. It's one of those college majors you probably have never heard of. Tell your parents you want a PhD in it, and they might imagine you sitting in a lab doing esoteric experiments on fruit flies. My guest, Dr. Jack Lawson, dreamed of exploring the oceans and emulating Jacques Cousteau from the time that he was a young boy. Now he's working with the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans. Whether it's studying sea lions, leatherback turtles, whales, or other species at risk, his findings will help enlighten all of us on how to protect our big blue planet.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
I'm not much of a reader, but I do wish I were more well-read.
There are so many great books coming out. I wish I could find a way to keep up.
Audible.com makes it easy to stay well-informed and catch up on your reading simply by listening. Audiobooks from Audible turn downtime into uptime. You'll be more productive and become well-read.
Now I'm able to catch up on all the great books I've been wanting to read.
With Audible, I feel smarter.
Pet Life Radio listeners, try Audible.com now and get your first 30 days of Audible Listener Gold Membership Plan free. And get a free audiobook. Choose from over 100,000 titles. To get this great deal, go to audibledeals.com. That's audibledeals.com.
Pet Life Radio, the number one pet radio network on the planet, joins forces with iHeartRadio to put the power of your pets in your pocket.
Awesome.
Download the iHeartRadio app and rock Pet Life Radio on your phone, on your tablet, on your Xbox, in your car. Pet talk, pet tunes, and fun pet times. Pet Life Radio and iHeartRadio. Positively possum.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz with The Pet Doctor, and I'm here in St. John's, Newfoundland, Canada, with Dr. Jack Lawson. And Dr. Lawson, tell me a little bit about your background, what you are doing here in St. John's.
Well, it spans a long period of time. I came as a graduate student in 1981 to Newfoundland. At the time, it was quite a different place than it is now, and I came to do graduate work to study seals, actually, seal behavior, with a lady at Memorial University here. And I studied seal behavior around Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, and Scotland, and did that for my master's and my PhD. Following the PhD, I did some work with marine protected areas on the north coast of Newfoundland, and was then hired by a consulting company out of Toronto, LGL Limited, and they do a lot of environmental impact work around marine mammals and underwater sound kind of issues. So I did work with clients in Canada, the U.S., South America, Europe, around the world. And a few years later, in 2002, Fisheries and Oceans Canada, where I currently work, was looking to hire somebody here to look at species at risk impacts and species at risk concerns around cetaceans, so whales, dolphins, and porpoises, and leatherback turtles is another big thing in the area. And so I applied for the job and started to work here in 2002. So my background in seals first, and then marine mammal impacts, served me well moving into the whale world. So from the time I was a young kid, I used to watch all the Jacques Cousteau specials and loved the whales, and never realized that, you know, 30 years later I'd be actually coming in the back door as a whale biologist. So here my tasks have been to look at first abundance, so we need a count. There hasn't been surveys since actually before I came. Before 1981, there was the last aerial surveys, people looking at numbers of whales, and so that's been one of my tasks. but more recently, because I'm getting to be an older guy with lots of experience in noise and industrial effects, that's right, I've begun to try and develop ways where our government can assess the potential impacts of some big projects. So a lot of governments around the world until recently, if someone has proposed, say, a big wind farm or a new shipping terminal or a seismic operation or something, have looked at the operation piecemeal. So someone will come in and look at the impact on birds. Someone will come in and look at the impact of chemicals on crabs. And nobody's put all the pieces together to assess the whole operation. So that's one of the things that I do now. So I've sort of got my hat in the helping the regulators, helping the reviewer side, but also still doing some of the basic research on the abundance of whales, the behavior of whales, things like that.
I was reading some information about the whales, and I found it fascinating. Being from Southern California, last year I had the opportunity to go out of Dana Point on a whale watching boat, and we actually saw a blue whale. It went under the catamaran. It was fabulous to see. It was huge. At a distance, you couldn't get the impression of how big it was. When it went under the catamaran, it's like, please, I hope you know we're above you. Do not reach at this particular time. But I was reading that on the West Coast, that the blue whale is pretty abundant, about 5,000 to 10,000, they figure. But here in the Atlantic, their numbers are really very diminished. Why?
Well, like most places in the world, a lot were killed during the whaling. Happened in the Atlantic as it did in the Pacific, as it happened in the Antarctic. So I know for blue whales, they estimate that perhaps as many as 300,000 blue whales were removed from the world's oceans, mostly in the Antarctic, but in the Atlantic as well. And for reasons that we don't really understand, while the Pacific population of blue whales seems to be recovering, you see calves and the numbers seem to be growing, the same has not been true for the Atlantic. So where I work on the Northwest Atlantic, on the western side of the Atlantic, we think the number of adult blue whales in our waters is only 250. So it's actually a number equal to or smaller than the number of the highly endangered right whales. And when you fly surveys, as I've done for many years and been on boats, I've only seen one calf, a young animal, the whole time I've been out here doing work. So it doesn't seem like they're reproducing at all either. And so for some reason, they're just not recovering in our area here as they have in the Pacific. The other side of the Atlantic is a different story. They seem to be doing a little better over there. But again, I think the numbers over there, and I'm not an expert on that side of the Atlantic, I don't think the numbers are also growing as well as they have in the Pacific.
The other thing I was reading about, too, I guess it was recently back in April, that several whales were crushed in ice. And I'm thinking, you know, you guys swim in this ocean all the time. You should be aware the ice is there. You can dive, get away from this. Why did it happen? Any idea?
Well, this is a really interesting story from a sort of a natural history standpoint. And you know, one of the things that we're trying to do when we're looking at this small population of blue whales is look at what factors do we think might be limiting their recovery or what are the risks. And it's been known since there's records going back before the 1800s of whales of all kinds, not just blues, killed in ice around Newfoundland and Labrador. As your listeners may not know, from the other coast, ice plays a big part in the ecosystem in the Northwest Atlantic, particularly, say, 50 years ago. We had a lot more ice then than we do recently for various, maybe, global change reasons. But it's a very dynamic environment, especially in the spring. So you'll have, over the course of January, February, ice forms, it freezes on top of the water, where you get animals like harp seals and hooded seals and so on that haul out and have their pups and so on the ice. So it's a very important component. But then in March, April, May, it begins to warm and things break up and it begins to get very dynamic, this ice pack. And it's driven by currents and winds. And of course, here we have very strong winds in Newfoundland and Labrador.
Yes, my hairdo has just been shot.
And it's unpredictable as well. And what happens on the southwest coast of Newfoundland, you can think of it like an upside down teacup facing southwards. And what we've seen in the past is when there's a lot of ice off the coast and you get an easterly wind, it pushes the ice away from the opening of this south facing bay, this cup, if you will. We also know that there's lots of animals that in the springtime are waiting to get back into the Gulf of St. Lawrence to get into that cup to feed and so on. Blue whales are them, but we get white-beaked dolphins, fin whales, minke whales, that thing. What we think happens, and what we think happened this last April, was that we had winds from the east for a while. blew the pack ice away. Whales swam up into that open water to feed, as they do in the early spring. Then we had very strong winds from the west for a few days, and it drives the ice back in, but it doesn't drive it parallel to the coast. It closes the cup first, and then the ice pushes up into the bottom of the cup. And so we think what happened, and you could see it on the ice maps, the ice moved from the south and the west, came in, probably there was blue whales in there, trapped them with the ice, and they either were crushed in the ice or drowned because they're, you know, unable to swim far enough to get out underneath the ice. And we've seen it happen many years, but usually only maybe one blue whale, two blue whales occasionally. But this last winter we had 9 dead adult blue whales, of which at least 5 were adult females. So for a species that you're trying to recover, that's a loss of potentially 4 or 5% of what we think is the adult population in one event. And that's 9 that we saw. There could have been more. We don't know. So it was a great event as a scientist, because you could say, well, here's the trap. Here's a natural history event that's working. Here's an event that we can't necessarily control as humans, so you couldn't bring an icebreaker in and free the animals because the ice was under high pressure. You can't really scare the animals out of the area, maybe, because they're there for a reason. They're in to feed, and if you scare them out, maybe you'll have an impact. So you had kind of a natural event. But on the other hand, you're saying, I'm trying to recover this population, and boom, there's 5% of your adults gone in one event. So it was quite a shocking thing to see.
Dr. Lawson, this is going to be very simplistic, but okay, on the Pacific, we have all these blue whales. Is it feasible to transport them over to the Atlantic and say we're going to reseed this area? Like zoos many times will have endangered species, raise them, and then release them back to the wild. So can you take them from one ocean to the other?
Well, you can imagine with these animals that are the largest animals we know of in the world, and while the animals in the North Atlantic are a little smaller than the Antarctic, these animals were still, I'm trying to convert to feet, say 85 feet long, and would weigh in excess of 100 tons.
Wouldn't be easy.
To try and move something that big, even if it was a piece of stone, would be difficult, let alone an animal that needs to be kept cool, is breathing. If it's ashore under its weight will actually stop its heart or from breathing, so you'd have to have it in a tank.
It's
not feasible. Plus, we know from studies of acoustics around the world that different populations of blue whales have different patterns of calls. So you can tell a Pacific whale from an Atlantic whale by listening to the calls.
Like a Canadian accent?
Could be, yep, that kind of thing. And so the question then becomes, well, maybe if you had a Pacific blue whale here, and he's making his Pacific blue whale call, and there's a girl Canadian, you know, whale from this side.
I don't understand you.
Perhaps she's not interested in him because he's not singing the right kind of song. So even if you brought in an animal from another area, there's no guarantee that you would make an improvement to the population. So I think we have to hope that through any efforts we can make and through reducing the risks of ship strikes or whatever we can possibly do, that the population will come back in its own.
And that what I find amazing also, ship strikes. Here you have this animal with its fantastic sonar ability. It doesn't know the ship is there. The ship is moving too quickly. Any idea what the premises of why there are these fatal ship accidents?
There's lots of theories, and we know there's species differences. For instance, fin whales seem to be the ones that figure most prominently in the ship strike records. And when I've been in the field, it's amazing to watch fin whales. They'll actually come from miles away and pass right in front of the ship that you're on. It's almost like they like to play chicken in front of the boats. And
watching dolphins do that too.
Do so well, and they'll end up wrapped around the bow. There's also the other fact that, you know, when you've got a big container ship moving through the water, it's producing a sound field around itself, generated mostly by the sounds of the propellers and engines at the rear of the ship, and there's actually an acoustic shadow in the front. So the quietest place around a moving container ship is off the front of the ship. So if you're a whale somewhere in the water ahead and there's a vessel coming and you're looking for the quietest place to get away from the sound, it actually might be in the path of the ship. If you go to one side or the other, the sound could actually get louder. So for an animal that's trying to avoid a noisy approaching sound, maybe it just puts itself in the wrong place.
Is there any industry standards now to try to protect these animals by making the front, the bow of the boat, somewhat more noisy?
People have thought about that, of sort of putting more, like, we have things here that they put on cars called moose whistles, and the idea is it's a high-frequency sound and the animal will hear the car coming from a long distance away. I'm not aware of any successful application of that yet. I know one of the things that's really interesting now is they're looking at vessel quietening around the world, because we know with changes in the acidity of the ocean, the propagation of sound is going to get better and better in the next few years with global warming. And that's a bad thing for animals that are exposed to sound, because it means sound will propagate further as the ocean warms. And so while quieting vessels is admirable, they contribute a lot to the underwater soundscape and the noise that's under there, it will make it then harder to detect these vessels, to make them quieter. So on one side, you want to have a quiet ship. It's a more efficient ship. But on the other hand, if it's a quieter ship, then maybe the whales will even have less of a chance to avoid it. I'm not sure.
And that was part of your studies, correct, that you were doing studies on industrial seismic sounds and how it was affecting marine life?
Yeah, so shipping activities, seismic exploration, offshore oil developments like fixed platforms, all of those produce noise which goes into the sea. And one of the things that everybody in the world is concerned about in marine resources is this change in the distribution or the behavior of those animals as a result of that sound. So a lot of my work that I did before I came to the department was looking at the potential effects of seismic. So you've got a vessel that's towing a several thousand cubic inch air gun array that every 12 seconds or so is blasting, making an air bubble underwater, which makes a big sound pulse, goes down into the bedrock and reflects back and gives the geologists the information about what's there. But some of that noise is propagated horizontally out from the array, and it can transmit quite a long distance. And there's some evidence that different species of seals, different species of whales and birds even are displaced by this sound. And so the question becomes, is it, if you displace a whale for an hour from an area and it comes back and feeds, is that a concern? If you displace a group of feeding animals for a week because you're doing seismic, is that a concern? So there's a lot of studies around the world now that are trying to focus in on that question and say, there's differences in the response depending on the context and the species and all that. But is that response something that we have to be concerned about, or is it just a temporary blip for the animal and they can accommodate that? So that's the big question now is, you know, can you disturb an animal and not be concerned about its long-term welfare? And that's a lot of things that we don't know yet.
So Dr. Lawson, with this study of seismics and the study of the cetaceans and the leatherback turtles, all this you're doing, I think many landlubbers are going, what difference does it really make? You have this huge ocean. If you have this small little area off of Newfoundland that's being affected, is it really going to affect me here in the middle of Kansas?
Yeah, and it's the classic disconnect from us terrestrial animals who, you know, we use the sea as a source of entertainment, a source of food, and a source of petrochemical resources. And as you alluded to before we started the interview, you know, people have to get a realization that everything's interconnected. So for an animal like a leatherback turtle here, you think, well, why do we care if there's fewer leatherback turtles, for instance, in the Atlantic? Well, we know that jellyfish numbers are on the rise because of warming oceans, we think, and other things. We know that jellyfish feed on fish eggs, for instance, cod eggs, herring eggs, things like that in the water. They even feed on juvenile fish. So you've got a predator that's rising in abundance, potentially scattered in more areas and feeding on the fish that we as people would like to eat. What controls those numbers? Well, what controls those numbers are things that eat jellyfish, like leatherback sea turtles, like sunfish. So those numbers and the distribution of those turtles actually could be quite important in controlling the numbers of jellyfish. So there's a really indirect thing. So by having more leatherback turtles there, perhaps we'll have less jellyfish, meaning maybe we have more fish eggs and more larval fish survive, which means the guy in Kansas gets to have his cod dinner.
We are all so interrelated. It is amazing.
I've been chatting with Dr. Jack Lawson, research scientist with the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans. Following this commercial message, we'll continue our navigation of the oceans of the North Atlantic and the animals that live in it.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Hi, this is Tim Link, animal communicator and pet expert, and host of Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Have you ever wanted to know what your pet is really thinking? Do you want to find out if they truly understand what you're trying to tell them? Ever wish you could build a better understanding and closer relationship with your pet? Well, now you can. Learning to communicate with animals is a four-part on-demand workshop. In the workshop, you'll learn the essential techniques that are necessary to communicate with animals, including what is animal communication, breathing correctly to achieve the perfect state to communicate with your animals at a deeper level, using guided meditation exercises and method to communicate with animals, and how to send and receive information from your animals. So if you're wanting to learn how to communicate and connect with your animals at a deeper level, visit PetLifeRadio.com/workshop and purchase and download Learning to Communicate with Animals. You'll be glad you did.
Hi, I'm Dr. Robin Gansert, President and CEO of American Humane Association, the country's first national humane organization, here to tell you about our new show, Be Humane, on Pet Life Radio. Each week, we'll be bringing you the latest news and issues affecting our animal friends, and we'll also be bringing you interviews with Hollywood's biggest animal advocates, here to share tales about their pets and what they're doing to promote a more humane world. Our own highly experienced staff and friends of the organization will also join us each week to share what they're up to in the animal world. I hope you'll stop by. Until then, let's always remember to be humane.
Every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets
on Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
You study, we were talking a little bit about the Canadian accent of a whale here, a blue whale, and then somebody in the Pacific. But I know you also studied communications in seals. How do they communicate? I think people think of seals and their little squeaks and whistles, and yeah, they're just making cute noises. But what did you learn?
Well, again, I mean, different species of seals have different calls, just as the whales do. So there's some animals like bearded seals in the Arctic, which are, some have called them like the blues, the canaries of the sea. They have these great long trills that last many minutes underwater. So males in the darkest of winter will be under the ice just calling these long, trilling, beautiful calls for females. Other species like gray seals and harbor seals, we know they make underwater calls. Males have these, what they call maritories instead of territories. They're underwater territories. They maintain and they're making grunts and they do flipper slaps on the water and that sort of thing. So that's one way they communicate in air. But really, a lot of the seals are sort of master in-air callers. So for a lot of the animals that we have on this side of the world, they're earless seals in the North Atlantic. So they're the gray seals, harbor seals that are out on the land, and they're grunting and growling. These are all the things people have probably heard in zoos or haulouts in California, that kind of thing. So there's the vocal side. So obviously if someone's growling at you, it's sending a message. But they're also, like humans, master visual communicators. So for gray seals, when I did my PhD work, we know the gray seals are also communicating by visual displays. So males will open up and gape. You won't actually hear anything when you listen to the recording. It looks like he's just kind of going, oh, you hardly hear anything. But he's got this big pink open mouth with all these teeth, and it's sending probably a pretty clear message to the
I think I understand that if I'm another male, yes.
And they do side-on displays where they kind of turn their head and they have this big nose. We know hooded seals, which breed on ice, and they're an interesting animal because they only nurse for 4 days. They go from birth to weaning their pup in 4 days, and then the female's gone. So the males that are there have a 1 4-day shot in a year to mate with a female.
The pressure's on,
and they have these very elaborate visual displays. They have a hood on top of their nose. They blow up into this big balloon. They can blow out their nasal septum like a big piece of bubble gum out of one nostril, and
oh,
they shake
very
that
sexy.
Around.
Extremely just sexy.
All the stuff that the ladies love, apparently.
Well, I'm glad I'm not a hooded seal. That may just not do it for me, but okay, fine. You also, I understand, were studying foraging, so where these animals are getting their food. And I know when I was interviewing on the Pacific and talking to the director of the Marine Mammal Center, they were concerned with so much of the refuse from the land, our trash, our debris, everything being dumped into the ocean, and animals eating that. And I don't know if they have it here in the Atlantic.
Certainly.
They have the islands of trash that just form out there.
I'm not sure if we have those here. I'm probably not an oceanographer. It would be better on that. But I certainly would suspect that we have the same trash issues here. We have the same diets. We do laundry. So our polyesters and little tiny fibers go into the ocean here, I'm sure, just as well as everywhere else. When I've been out collecting jellyfish as part of our turtle studies, there's certainly plastics in the water. You see everything from Barbie dolls down to little tiny things there. We've done dissections of dead turtles and found bits of netting and plastic and stuff inside them. So it's certainly an issue, I think, here as it is anywhere in the world. For seals, a lot of those seals are feeding higher up in the food chain. So for a whale that might be feeding on krill or something, has maybe a greater chance of picking up plastic than something that's feeding on a large fish. But it's something that I think we just haven't looked at yet here in the Atlantic. So plastics are a big concern for us for bycatch issues. So netting has a plastic in the ocean. We have these ghost nets, as they do elsewhere in the world, where a fish net will be lost because of a storm or something, and it'll sit on the bottom and fish. The animals rot. It floats to the surface. The rotting stuff falls out. It sinks back down and continues fishing. And we found those with porpoises and seals and all kinds of things in them. And as well, we get plastics, like, you know, these beer six-packs you can see, like the little plastic rings that hold the bottles together. We get those on young seals here. You know, they'll put their head through to see what it is, and they'll end up with it around the neck. We've got discarded ropes and things wrapped around seals. So like all parts of the world, plastic is an issue for us here. But I'm perhaps not the expert to talk about floating islands of trash in the Atlantic. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't have the exact same issues here that they do in the Pacific.
And when I was speaking to Dr. Jeff Bohm at the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, that particular mammal center is part of a network there on the Pacific side. Do you have something similar here on the Atlantic?
There's a number of groups here, depending on the species you're working at. So there's a group that's based in Europe, the North Atlantic Marine Mammal Commission, and they do studies of primarily pinnipeds, but also minke whales and other kind of things. And so they are interested in the issues of toxicology and plastic pollutions in marine mammals. Some of it from a biological perspective, so how is it impacting the animals, but also because some of the client nations that are in this group eat marine mammals. So they harvest seals or they harvest whales. And so for them, it's bringing the plastic right back to the people. And so that's an issue for them that they're concerned about. Here on this side of the Atlantic, as I said, we haven't heard much about plastics in marine mammals yet, but I suspect as we continue studying, it will turn out to be an issue. The Northwest Atlantic colleagues in the United States would know more about that sort of issue. I know for us, we're concerned at this point, it seems more about things like petrochemical spills. So the Gulf oil type spills seem to be something that people are concerned about. And then the changes in the whole ecosystem based on fishing. So if you fish out a prey stock, how does that impact things like marine mammals?
And having the impact, I was reading about the Canadian Species at Risk program that you have going on and invasive species in the ocean. And I'm very naive thinking, boy, you got this huge ocean. How can you have an invasive species just comes into one area? I can see you have something that's brought into the Great Lakes. It's a closed area, but correct me how I'm wrong.
Well, we've got a few issues with invasive species now. And if in the context of Newfoundland and Labrador, from Europe, a green crab was brought over. And it's a small crab, but it's extremely aggressive. And it has multiple impacts in that it competes for the same food as a native crab species. It has a habit of trimming and eating seagrass, you know, the small grassy beds on the bottom of the ocean, which are nurseries for a lot of our important larval fish. So there's an indirect effect there. It looks like because they denude the bottom and displace all the other animals, perhaps even lobster fishermen are impacted. Some of the cod around the coast have begun to eat green crabs. So the question is that a good food for them to be forced to eat these little spiny different kind of food species? So there's a real local example of an invasive species. On a grander scale, with global warming, we know that the ice cover in the Arctic is disappearing in the summers. And there's lots of plans by companies and governments around the world that once this is open enough, it'll be an extremely important transshipment route. So if we want to go from Europe to China, it's much quicker to go across the Northwest Passage than it is. A lot of these vessels bring things stuck to them, as you know, but they also have ballast water inside. And there's various plans too. Oh, we'll heat the water a few degrees and that'll kill the larvae, or we'll exchange the water 100 miles offshore before we go through. I hope those work, but a lot of people who work on invasive species are pretty sure that we're going to end up with different species in the north. So you bring in a different species, and it's like the Australian case where you bring in different species of animals that are placental animals, and the marsupials just could not compete. They didn't evolve in that situation. And it could be the same in the Arctic, where some kind of invertebrate is brought in, maybe that feeds on the stuff that's important to walruses or whale species that feed close to the bottom, that kind of thing. So we have all of these potential impacts from invasive species as a byproduct of what would seem economically to be a benefit to have this open water passage during the summer, but it's fraught with peril, I think.
The ocean is so huge and the ocean is so fragile, and every person needs to be aware, even when you're in the middle of Kansas, of how you're affecting the oceans around you. Dr. Jack Lawson, Canadian Fisheries and Ocean, I appreciate you very much taking your time and talking to my listeners today on The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. Thank you very much for listening. Please listen again next week. We'll have more information on how to make you the best possible pet owner. Thanks for listening.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.